The idea that the president says, I am breaking the law, he won't admit he's breaking the law, but I am doing acts which are clearly beyond the law and I will continue to do them, is a challenge to the rule of law in this country, such as we have not seen since 1861, since the rebellion by the South that said we will break the laws because we will break away from this country. How can we remedy this? Well, the House should be having hearings, official hearings with subpoena power, to look into this and to take action. I hope that this hearing will lead to that. I do not trust that it will, because I do not believe that the current leaders of this House have the gumption to stand up for the Constitution. I hope I'm proved wrong. Secondly, I wrote a letter the day after this was announced to the Attorney General asking for a special prosecutor, the ACLU, and others have followed suit, because obviously, if you're dealing with what appears to be a criminal conspiracy by the President, the Vice President, the Attorney General, and others, you cannot ask the Attorney General and the people under him to fairly investigate that. That's why we have the statute that authorizes the appointment of a special prosecutor. Obviously, they will dismiss this out of hand, because they will not admit that this is how real this is. Thirdly, the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights have brought two lawsuits seeking injunctive relief, and they will oppose this, claiming that nobody has standing, that no one is injured. And given the current Supreme Court, they may get away with a standing claim. I don't know. I do know one thing that I hope will give pause to every official who is asked to carry out illegal acts, as well as to the president, and that is that these are clearly crimes, and that crimes are prosecutable, and the statute of limitations lasts beyond the term of this president. Under the next president, this president, the vice president, the attorney general, and anyone who participates in what are clearly crimes could be prosecuted. And I hope people will understand that and will govern their actions accordingly. Let me ask Professor Turley. You stated that, but before I do that, let me say that my belief that Congress, that this House will not stand up for its responsibilities, I hope will be proved wrong. Because if it doesn't launch the proper investigation and the proper hearings and the proper actions, it will be greatly endangering American liberties, and it will be saying, why do we need a Congress at all if the President can do anything he wants just by claiming national security? And if he can just violate the laws that we pass with impunity. Professor Turley, you said that that these were clearly crimes, and under Section 1809, it's someone who, under color of law, meaning a government official, who wiretaps outside the exclusivity clause against the FISA law, as is being done here, is guilty of a crime punishable by up to 5 years in jail and a $10,000 fine. Do you believe that these are high crimes and misdemeanors?
Well, you know, it's ironic because the two areas I've done a lot of writing in is federal surveillance and impeachment. So this
and
is.
I remember you from the prior impeachment hearings.
A perfect storm for me, but frankly, I do. If you believe that the president has violated the criminal provisions of these laws, I don't see how you could possibly claim it would not qualify under the impeachment standard. There have been a lot of people who have said things like, well, he was doing it for the correct motivation. He was doing it to protect the country. Most high crimes and misdemeanors, as they've been defined in the past, have involved questions of official conduct. In fact, as you recall in the hearing that we had on impeachment, one of the great issues was, can private conduct fall under the impeachment standard? And we took different views on that point. But I think that there's no question it would. And also the question of what the president's position on the crimes would be is a little bit ambiguous. I don't see how you can argue that this does not violate the statute, but he's arguing that regardless of what the statute may say, he makes one statutory argument that I actually satisfied the statute, which is pretty darn weak. But then his backup is whatever the statute may have said, I trump it with my inherent authority. That's precisely the issue impeachment goes to. Regardless of what a federal court may say about the crimes, that's not your domain. Your domain and responsibility is that if a president has committed a criminal act, you are obligated to hold hearings. And what I would caution members of this body is you're establishing a precedent by not holding hearings.
Official hearings.
Right, because it doesn't mean that you're going to actually find or actually impeach a president and send it to the Senate. But at a minimum, you can't establish precedent that you're not even going to hold hearings in terms of crimes were committed by the president against citizens of the United States.
Can I just suggest one thing and comment on it, and then my time probably already has expired. The question from the high crimes and misdemeanors point of view is not really whether a criminal act was committed. As you point out, that's not our provenance. But the purpose of the impeachment provision was precisely, if you read the Federalist, to protect American liberty against the encroachments of a chief executive who would abuse his or her power to encroach upon liberty, regardless of whether it's a crime or not. But if it's a crime, it's a little more clear. So the question here really is, in terms of is it a high crime or misdemeanor, is it an unconstitutional encroachment upon liberty beyond the power of the president and so abusing his office?
Well, I think that actually this type of violation should be a textbook example of an impeachment issue, because not only is it a federal crime, but it violates the doctrine of separation of powers. And so at issue is not just criminal conduct, but a rejection of the central premise of the system. When the president held up his hand and took an oath to God that he would uphold the United States Constitution, he was promising to uphold the doctrine of separation of powers. When a president says that he can't live within those limitations, it is sort of a self-disqualificating concession in terms of holding that office. And so I would submit to you that you're absolutely right. It doesn't have to be a crime, but in this case, I think it clearly is a crime.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much, Mr. Nadler. What I'm going to do, I've got just one question that I'd like to take up with you. But before I do, I wanted to ask Attorney Bruce Fine this one question. What would you have done when you were the Deputy Attorney General under President Reagan if you had learned about a program like this, sir?
My baptism in Washington was Watergate. I came to the Justice Department at the time of Archibald Cox's discharge. And I very much revered Elliot Richardson. He was the Attorney General at the time. William Ruckelshaus was the Deputy Attorney General. Both of them resigned. Judge Bork, who then fell into the leadership post by default, was prepared to resign until he was urged by Ruckelshaus and Richardson to stay on to keep the special prosecutor's office alive. I think those are the standards that ought to apply here. You can't tell in advance what, you know, in retrospect, how you would have acted, but it does seem to me that an attorney has an obligation in the Justice Department to secure and defend the Constitution of the United States. And in cases of clear and open and notorious breaches, I think resignation is the only method of responsible conduct. If I could make just one additional observation, Mr. Chairman and other members, as a practical matter, I think if we're going to move forward and try to get a renunciation of this claim of omnipotence of the president during wartime, which in effect means forever because we'll be fighting terrorism forever, if it has a confrontational element to it, crimes, there's going to be an offishness and a difficulty and a fight over information that isn't going to be constructive. Even if there have been sins in the past, the best way to try to approach this is to say, but we need to get recognition by all, especially the executive branch, that separation of powers is alive. You don't require, you know, Henry IV at Canossa groveling, self-flagellation, but a recognition without casting a particular characterization of the past that is not consistent with our principles, and that going forward we agree it maybe can be unwritten understandings of how the president consults and works with Congress during wartime and fighting terrorism. I think that whatever we, and this is not the time initially to say impeachment is what we want to have. We need to recognize after 9/11, everybody was frightened. Maybe the president overreached. No one knew whether they're sleeper cells. But we're well beyond that. Now is the time for sober second thoughts. The president and the administration should be given a chance not to have to grovel, but to say, yeah, maybe we now have our senses and maybe we overreached and we will agree to a set of ground rules going forward. Now, if he then balks at that, that is a time to say, now we really do have a King George III, and who received a coronation rather than an inauguration in 2004, and we've got to go forward. But as you well know, if you're getting involved with the executive branch and fighting over information, you'd be in lawsuits for 5 or 6 years, and we'll make very little progress. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that response that goes back into history and into another administration. I appreciate your candor, Attorney Fine. The question that I have to present is essentially, where do we go from here? Attorney Carolyn Fredrickson has given us a list of to-do items that I thought were excellent. And while we were in the testimony here this morning, I have signed a letter to all phone and internet providers to inquire how and when they have turned over customer content and records, as has been reported to the press, to the government. And once we can confirm what access the government has and how it's been used, I think that we can move forward. I now invite any of you to make any additional recommendations for our to-do list for what I am certain will be a growing number of members in the Congress that will be joining us on other hearings that will follow this one.
I would encourage you, Mr. Chairman, to consider holding some hearings not in Washington, D.C., or sort of like a rump parliament here, to go back to British history, but to get a sense of how the American people, who are not viewing this as an academic separation of powers issue, feel about the sense of intimidation or aura of government overreaching with the principles that the president has announced. And there's going to be different views out there. But I do think this is an issue that has to be kept away of being an inside the beltway issue where one party or one group is trying to get ahead of another group. It's so large and so important for the institutions and for the people to come together and say, there's one thing we ought to all agree on when we're fighting terrorism, and that is we keep intact the separation of powers, which is the Bill of Rights for posterity.
An excellent recommendation.
I would echo that as long as the House refuses to undertake its oversight responsibilities, that you all continue what you are doing today, which is to talk about it and to educate the American people about it, and that is key. I think the one place that you will have perhaps an opportunity to question the administration about it is that every time an official from one of the intelligence agencies involved, or the Justice Department, or the Department of Homeland Security appears before your committees, that the questions be asked about how you can be sure that the answers you are getting are, in fact, candid answers. If the questions have to do with what are you doing and how are you protecting American civil liberties, can you know, as long as the president continues to make the claim that he's making, which is that I have this power and I can exercise it in secret without telling you, and that's a way to demonstrate to people what is at stake here.
Attorney Fredrickson.
I did want to add one thing back inside the Beltway. Senator Spector has announced that he's holding a hearing. I think that's creditable, but I think it's very, very important that members of this body explain to the American public what a real hearing is. We need to insist that this is not a one-shot deal, that it's a whitewash. They go up there, they have a chance to give their side of the story, and then that's it, because I think that will not do service to what the American people really deserve. So I would ask you to look into what you believe would really inform us all about this program, what the senators need to inquire into, and not allow this administration to characterize Attorney General Gonzalez going up and speaking once to the Senate as an appropriate oversight activity.
Excellent. Mr. Professor Turley.
The only thing I would add is I'm not as solicitous as Bruce is when it comes to issues of impeachment. To me, impeachment is not an effort to get a president to come around. It's not the job of this body to, you know, try to coax a president into fulfillment of his constitutional duties. This president has already stated quite clearly that he believes he can violate federal law. That, for our system, is the equivalent of a declaration of war on the separation of powers. But one thing I would encourage you to think about as a collateral matter is how important it is for Congress to pass a shield law for journalists. This is a great example of why journalists need to have a federal shield law. The fact that the administration's first act was to pursue the whistleblower and potentially threaten these journalists shows how vital it is for us to have a statutory protection supporting the First Amendment. If the administration continues the way it's going, it's going to significantly diminish the ability of journalists to hear from whistleblowers. I'm referring to the fact that this administration has used a waiver that is given to all officials in a particular office, and they are all asked to sign and waive confidentiality, so that if you don't, you self-identify, but if you sign it, then you're signing something false unless you actually did waive. We're in a very precarious position unless we get a shield law so that these types of abuses can be disclosed.
Mr. Bamford.
I just have one small suggestion. I think one of the problems in terms of the public paying attention to this is they have the idea when you talk about wiretapping that it's some FBI agent climbing up a telephone pole outside their house and putting some alligator clips on a wire. And they have no concept of the whole idea of signals intelligence, which is what NSA engages in, which means whole-scale eavesdropping, eavesdropping on the entire streams of communications entering and leaving the country, virtually everything entering and leaving the country. And if there were any more hearings that would further elaborate how the NSA does its job and the difference between the public conception of a wiretap and signals intelligence, I think it would be very helpful for the public to understand that it's not just somebody that may climb up a wire, but it's somebody who just pushes a button in an office thousands of miles away. And it's their cell phone, their email, their BlackBerry, their fax. Everything goes into it. Thank you.
So good. Did you want the last word, Attorney Fine?
I would just suggest consideration of a joint House-Senate committee, as was done with the Iran-Contra investigation. I think that does underscore the importance of the issue to the American people, and it has a sustaining element to it, as Iran-Contra did, that I think would further illuminate the question.
Thank you so much. Mr. Hirsch.
Thank you. Can I just say that as a citizen, I've heard today that the president's obviously broken the law, that he's claimed unjust powers to himself, which is characteristic of tyrants and kings, that he has admitted that he's broken the law, and if you read the oath of office, he's not upheld the Constitution of the United States. I think it's time for us to act. I think to protect our civil liberties and our constitutional rights, it's important to hold him accountable, to hold the president and his entire administration accountable for their misbehaviors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. The chair recognizes Congressman Adam Schiff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to just, at the outset, before I ask a question or two, make a couple of the suggestions for immediate steps. And following up on your comments, Mr. Fine, I would hope that those within the administration that have been working on this program would immediately cease and desist from any further electronic surveillance not approved by the FISA court. If not, because very legitimate, very serious legal questions have been raised, then out of respect for their own potential liability, I would hope if there's anybody at DOJ that's watching this or at NSA that they're mindful of the very serious legal questions that have been raised, and that any future surveillance go through the FISA court. Second, I think that we should use the opportunity of the Patriot Bill Conference Committee to make it abundantly clear, if it's not clear already, and frankly, I think it is fairly clear, that Congress in the authorization to use military force was not authorizing the President to do electronic surveillance outside of FISA. And I think we have an opportunity legislatively, because if we wait for this to be resolved through litigation or even oversight hearings, if the administration continues to take a position that's going to continue this form of surveillance, then it's going to go on for months and months without abatement. So those are at least two things that I think could be done in the very near term. I wanted to push back just a little bit on your comment, Mr. Hirsch, and something you said, Mr. Turley, and that is that I don't believe the President has said that he believes he can violate federal law. I think what the President has said is that he believes he's not violating federal law. And part of the reason I'm not confident that the President will cease and desist is that I believe the part of the administration would view as an admission of culpability, or that it had been doing something it wasn't authorized to do. Basically, to me, what the administration is arguing in its legal papers, there are perhaps five arguments, as you point out, Mr. Turley, but for me, there's only really one credible argument, and that is it's a three-part argument. One, FISA allows exceptions. Two, the authorization to use military force is such an exception. And three, if it isn't, FISA is unconstitutional. Now, I don't, frankly, of the three, of those three points, the only one I think that has any merit is that FISA does allow exceptions. I don't think there's any merit, frankly, my point of view, to the argument that the authorization of using military force was such an exception. And indeed, as I think Mr. Van Hollen pointed out so eloquently in his opening statement, all of the debate that we've been having over FISA and the Patriot Bill is completely meaningless. The administration could have come into the first hearing and said, you can debate all you want. We don't care what you do with the Patriot Bill or with FISA. It doesn't matter because we can do what we want. You've already authorized it. And what's more, if you try to unauthorize it, it's unconstitutional. You lack the authority. Plainly, the administration, I think, believed that it still needed to come to Congress for authorization of just this type of surveillance under the Patriot Bill and under FISA. But I'd like to ask you, Mr. Turley, you, Mr. Fine, Ms. Martin, if you would, and Ms. Martin, I think your point is right on the money, because it was really nagging at me, too. For the very moment the administration argued that the mere disclosure of this surveillance was injurious to national security, that they couldn't come to the Congress without impairing national security on this, if the terrorists don't think that we're doing electronic surveillance, then they're a lot less sophisticated than they seem to be. And I agree completely. To them, they don't care whether it goes to the FISA court or not, but we do care. And the whole argument about whether it goes through FISA or not is somehow injuring national security, I don't buy. I think it's palpably false on its face. But what I would like to ask you is, what is the most credible argument you believe the administration has? Because you're all of one mind, really, on this panel, I'd like you to take the other voice today. What's the most credible argument they have, and why do you feel that that's not legally merited?
I think that the administration has not, in their most recent filing, claimed inherent constitutional power to ignore FISA on the theory that it's too much constraining of the President's hands. What it has argued is that it would be such a close constitutional question if FISA did attempt to constrain him, notwithstanding the authorization of use of force, that any ambiguity as whether the authorization for force overrode FISA should be resolved in favor of the overriding of FISA by the statute. That is, my judgment, is their best argument, and already on its face is so implausible that it's hard to, you know, have gradations here, because the argument basically comes down to the idea that they've articulated is that when it comes to conducting warfare, there are no limits that the Congress can place on the President. For example, you may recall during the Vietnam War, Congress prohibited Nixon from bombing in Cambodia. 1970. And this argument would be, well, the Congress couldn't do that. If Congress tried to prohibit the use of federal funds to send gunships to the Persian Gulf to launch missile attacks against an Iranian nuclear facility, the theory would be Congress is trying to handicap or arrest the president's ability to conduct the war. Now, I went back and looked at one of the early decisions of Chief Justice John Marshall, who was one who was who idolized George Washington. He fought in the Revolutionary War, and he wasn't abashed about executive powers. But during the War of 1812, the issue arose as to whether or not the president could confiscate and seize enemy property within the United States without any authority of Congress. And Chief Justice Marshall said no, said it appears to the court that the power of confiscating enemy property is in the legislature. This is a case, of course, not cited by the administration in their brief. And that's why I would say, even though that's their strongest argument, it's anemic.
I think I would say that their strongest argument is based on the claim that they need to do this as part of intelligence directed against the enemy. But the thing that, and that that's a constitutional authority on their part. I think that the difficulty with that argument is that they then claim that they can't adequately exercise that either within the statute or with the oversight of the FISA court, and that they can't adequately exercise that inside the United States, and that they haven't made that case, and that to make that case, they're going to have to read away the limits of the Fourth Amendment, because the Fourth Amendment says that searches and seizures in the United States have to be two things: reasonable, and unless there's a good reason to avoid it, have to have a warrant. And they can't make the case that they need to avoid FISA and still meet the requirements of the Fourth Amendment, even if the president does have some inherent presidential commander-in-chief authority to conduct surveillance on the enemy. The question is how and within what limits inside the U.S.
Congressman Schiff, I would, first of all, let me clarify what I meant when I said that the president believes he can violate federal law. As I lay out in the written testimony, and I think you've correctly laid out, what the administration is putting forward is a series of alternative arguments. And it is, frankly, it comes across as an intelligence operation in search of legal rationales. And the first one is that they are not violating the federal statute, because the statute says that you cannot conduct electronic surveillance under the color of law except as authorized by a statute. And they're claiming the force resolution is a statute that does that. I think on its face, that one can't be in the running, because it is perfectly absurd. The reason is that Congress had, in fact, refused to make some changes during that period to expand the authority of the president. The resolution itself was changed so not to be too broad. And nobody can cite to a single piece of evidence in legislative history. And as you know, you guys produce legislative history by the bushel load. No one can find a single page, a single reference, a hint that anyone thought that the resolution meant this. So that one we've got to take off the table. When I was learning to be a litigator, I was told that you have to follow what's called the red face test, that you have to make sure that any arguments you make in court, you don't get a red face, and that one violates the red face test. Now, the second argument is that the president has the inherent authority, regardless of FISA, to carry this out, that he, because we are at war, et cetera, that Congress cannot limit it. There's sort of two arguments in there, but dealing with both of them together, I think that's probably where their best option is. I mean, frankly, I think the only way they could get through this is to say that FISA is unconstitutional. I mean, it's the only clear argument to say, you just simply can't restrict me with regard to domestic surveillance. The problem with that argument is that, as we talked about, no limiting principle, is that it would involve any statute. You know, we've already heard that the president has said that he is reserving the right to violate the torture prohibition. We've seen with enemy combatants that he's reserved the right to strip citizens of all their rights, including access to counsel and to courts. We've seen here that they believe that regardless of that initial argument under FISA, at the end of the day, FISA may be unconstitutional because of his inherent authority. Well, then it doesn't matter what the statute is. It could be surveillance today. It could be a torture statute tomorrow. It could be a banking statute the next day. The point is the president's saying as long as I'm acting under the color of national security, I have an inherent authority that trumps the federal law. And that's probably their best one, but, boy, I'd hate to make that in a court of law.
Well, I want to thank you all. I just wanted to take 2 seconds to say, I think the last point that you made, and Mr. Fine, you made it also, others have in different forms, the fact that they're, what they're arguing is devoid of any limiting principle. Those are the words you use, Mr. Turley, I think is right on the mark. There is no way to limit the authority they're claiming. That's what's of such great concern.
I just wanted to add to my colleague's comments to your question, Congressman Schiff. I think what the very learned panelists have shown is that this is not an argument that's going to take place, at least in the president's mind, in a court of law, and that he thinks he's going to win in the court of public opinion. And I think that is why it is so critical that you're holding this hearing today, and why it is incumbent on Congress to continue such hearings, because without that, there will be no oversight and no holding this president accountable.
Thanks for that very illuminating question, Congressman Schiff, that you posed. Congressman Van Hollen.
I want to go back to what I think is this essential question of a limiting principle, because the way the Vice President has talked about this, the way the President, the Attorney General, has talked about it, it makes it sound like, well, this is a very, very narrow program as they have put it in place. Now, we don't know all the facts about how they're conducting these operations. But I think it's important that the American people know, number one, and I'd like all of you to confirm this if it's true, that the president, when he's conducting wiretapping operations overseas, he has the authority without going into a FISA court to undertake that wiretapping. Is that, would any, everyone agree with that? Okay. Exactly.
Or if he's intercepting conversations in Paris, he doesn't need to go to any court.
Exactly. Now, if you have two people here in the United States on tourist visas, neither of whom is a United States citizen or a resident of the United States, the president can wiretap their communications, or can he not wiretap those communications?
He needs a warrant. The Fourth Amendment covers everyone inside the United States, but the FISA provides for a lower standard to wiretap those people than to wiretap Americans and legal and.
Yeah, let me rephrase the question. With that, and just looking at FISA, not the Fourth Amendment issue. Under FISA, my understanding is that as long as there's not a significant probability that he is going to be wiretapping a United States person defined as a citizen of the United States or an alien lawfully admitted for permanent residence, the president can do that. But I guess we can follow up on that. The point I want to make is this, that I think there are a lot of American citizens out there saying this can't happen to me, the way the Vice President and the President are talking about, it'll never happen to me. And Mr. Bamford his testimony talked about exactly what happened before we had the FISA law in place and why the FISA provisions were put in place. And Mr. Hirsch's testimony is clear that even with this in place, you know, it looks like they've decided to ignore the law, and that's what this whole operation has been all about. But if you could just very briefly, in sort of layman's terms, talk about why it is the president's argument has no limiting principle, regardless of how they're putting it into operation, that the logic of their legal position means that the president can, if he so determines the interest of national security, wiretap the telephone conversations taking place between any of us in this room.
Representative Van Hollen, I think the easiest way is to describe the president's position as a codicil to something President Richard Nixon asserted, which was, if the president says to do it, it's constitutional, whether it's breaking into homes, Daniel Ellsberg, psychiatrist, or otherwise. That was repudiated. Now, all the difference that President Bush has maintained is, as long as I say I'm doing it in order to fight terrorism, then it's automatically legal. And I say, when he's making the assertion that if there's any provision that historically has been associated with wartime activity, I can do it on my own no matter what Congress says. That means we could have concentration camps like World War II. And even if Congress prohibited them by statute, he could say that's an incident of war. That is how broad and sweeping this is. And we didn't have to go back to 1861. Richard Nixon's in my lifetime, and I'm not all that old. And this is an example, again, of power trying to overreach itself unless it's checked. And that's what's at issue here. It seems a little academic, but it's having your liberties encroached upon by inches rather than miles all at once, and then you lose them on the installment plan rather than a balloon payment.
Thank you so much. Excuse me, Professor Turley.
There's another aspect to the lack of a limiting principle. We've been talking about the inherent authority argument advanced by the president, how that doesn't have a limiting principle. But there's other aspects that are equally extreme. For example, the president has put forward the principle of constitutional avoidance. His argument through the attorney general is that because he considers there to be ambiguity in whether he has his authority or not, that you have to avoid the conflict, that you have to read FISA in a way to recognize his authority. That argument would have no limits. First of all, there's more specific than FISA. I mean, FISA is as specific as you can get, and it's as clear as you can get. But the president's argument seems to be, if I don't accept its clear meaning, it's ambiguous, and therefore you have to avoid a conflict with me. Now, under that argument, the president could engage in, you know, interstate auto theft and say that I didn't think that I was prohibited from stealing cars and moving them across state lines. That's not what the constitutional doctrine's about. And so there's aspects, not just the constitutional claim on the Article II issue, that are quite extreme and without limits.
I just wanted to, as a litigator, I always like to articulate the other side's argument as powerfully as they might. And I think their most powerful argument on the no limit question is they would say, yes, no, you're wrong, that the limit on our domestic wiretapping is that we only wiretap individuals whom the president determines have some kind of connection or link to Al-Qaeda, an associated group, or terrorism. So that's not limitless, they would say. And I think that the response to that is, it's limitless because the president decides solely on his own and does so in secret. And we see what happens because Mr. Hirsch and his colleagues and other religious groups are now on those lists of the president's determination. And that we have a system that says when you want to make that kind of determination that someone is connected to terrorism, that the judiciary or some other branch, we have some oversight on that. And that's where the lack of limit comes in, is that the president is free to, on his own, pick and choose who he's going to go after.
Could I say something, please? I'm not an attorney, and so I'm not going to try to play one on TV here. I can't speak to the legality or the justice of what the president claims to be doing. To send his agents into a Quaker meeting house to violate my First and Fourth Amendment rights is as ludicrous as saying we had to burn the village in order to save it.
Just take a minute here, but just to agree with Mr. Hirsch there, during Watergate, one of the targets of NSA under Richard Nixon was the Quakers. I interviewed a official from NSA who told me that that was one of the targets Richard Nixon ordered, was to eavesdrop on the Quakers because they were active in the anti-war movement at the time. So these aren't frivolous worries, I don't think.
Now, Mr. Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to follow up on that line of questioning, because if the president in his own mind, determines that war protesters are undermining the war effort, does that make them fair game for wiretaps?
He's not rejected that idea, which is, as I say, a disturbing element. That is, in all of his explanations, both directly and through his surrogates, he's never said, of course, I can't do this. I remember at one recent press conference, a reporter asked him whether there are any limits, and his retort was, I'm not a dictator. He didn't say how he wasn't a dictator, but that was his response. And that's what's troublesome. He's refused to say there are any principles that he would utilize as a matter of executive self-restraint to say, I am just not going there. And that betrays a mindset that's very worrisome.
Ms. Martin, did you want to?
Well, I want to agree that allowing undercover FBI agents into religious meetings is seriously troublesome. But I want to also point out that what we've seen in the last 6 months is that the Defense Department, which is not subject to even the Ashcroft guidelines, appears to be sending people into religious meetings. And the NSA, of course, is part of the Defense Department. I suspect that if we could get the facts, we would discover that they have changed all of the rules and regulations about Defense Department surveillance of Americans, and that the NSA program is only one aspect of it, and the infiltration of groups like Mr. Hirsch by Defense Department elements is another aspect of it.
Sterling?
Part of the problem in terms of your question when you ask, is there any way that this can be limited so that people like Mr. Hirsch are not targeted, is that the president's argument doesn't lend itself to any moderate alternative position. That is, he has mapped out an extreme position that doesn't really have an alternative. That his position is that he's got this inherent authority, and that where Mr. Hirsch is protected is in the discretion of the president. And the important thing to remember is that once you say that something is committed to the inherent authority of the president on something like national security, courts do not question that judgment as a general matter. Courts don't come in and say, I think you were wrong that this person was a risk and not that person. If it's committed to the discretion of the executive branch, it goes into a realm of total discretion, because courts really don't exercise much of a role in questioning national security judgments. So part of the answer to your question, I think what the president would say is that, you know, we exercise this discretion. We have this internal review process. And, you know, I note that the Attorney General said that every 45 days or so they review this program. But the important thing to remember is that all of these reviews, all these procedures, are all self-contained within the executive branch. And the president's people around him are strong believers in the sort of unitary executive theory, so that whenever you hear about these procedures, they lack one notable characteristic. And that is that they are outside of the president's control.
Thank you so much. Mr. Wexler.
Failure of this Congress to exercise its responsibility of oversight, and I think the fairly reasonable expectation that the leadership of this Congress will continue to stubbornly refuse to exercise our constitutional oversight. It seems to me that the only venue or vehicle in which to successfully force the leadership of this Congress to act is, in fact, in the court of public opinion. Yesterday, Americans received the latest chilling threat from Osama bin Laden. I think most Americans, particularly after September 11th, presume that the President of the United States will act in the best interests of America in terms of our security interests. They want to give the President of the United States a benefit of the doubt. I think Congressman Van Hollen hit it on the head. I think most Americans, when they hear descriptions of surveillance and wiretaps, say, well, that can't happen to me. I'm just going to work. I'm just driving my kids to school. I'm just a retiree. I just go to church, or I just go to synagogue, or I just go and exercise my religious rights the way I wish. Ms. Martin talked about what I think is the administration's presentation of the exercise of their discretion as always couched in terms of a connection and link to terror. Professor Turley, I think, rightfully pointed out that, in essence, the president claims a exercise of discretion. So in that regard, I'd like to ask Mr. Hirsch, if I could. The president has exercised his discretion. The Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Rumsfeld, has exercised his discretion. The commanders at the NSA have exercised their discretion. The enlisted people who were ordered, I presume, to go and sit in the Quaker church in Palm Beach County, they follow their orders. Could you describe for us, and you have to some degree, but I think it's important for Americans to understand in the context of that question, it can't happen to me. Who was sitting in that Quaker church in Palm Beach County? Were these people that had traveled to Afghanistan in the 1990s? Were these people who had taken plane trips to Pakistan? People who had ongoing dealings with Iraqi agents? My understanding is there's a bunch of grandmothers were there. Could you describe for us so America understands the answer of the question, could it happen to me? Who was in that church when the Department of Defense ordered enlisted people to go spy on Americans?
Yes, I can. There was me, disabled, 59, father of two daughters. There was Evelyn Gratchow, 79 years old, a grandmother and an activist, a former union member. There was Deborah Smith, an Asian American, housewife. There was Javier del Sol, a Native American and a student. There was Marie Zwicker, the mother of Native American children and a nurse. There was Alan Taylor, a pharmacist, a retired pharmacist, and retired attorney. There was James Venable, an African American, a web designer, a marketing person, a businessman. There was his wife, Bonnie Redding, a European American like myself, who is a legal attorney, a real estate agent, and a direct marketing person. I hope I haven't left anyone out. And if I have, I hope they can forgive me. There were a number of other Quakers there as well. I can't name them all. But I do know that none of us had traveled outside the country. None of us had, to my knowledge, made any phone calls outside the country. We were just people interested in getting at some truth and educating our children, teaching them how to think, and giving them the facts so that they could make informed decisions.
The fact is, Mr. Hirsch, as I see it, and you haven't said it, but there isn't the slightest bit of connection between you or anybody in that church and anything to do with terrorism or the security of the United States. The fact is, what the Truth Project is a group that may have a philosophy that is adverse to the political philosophy and the political goals of the President of the United States. And as a result of that differing philosophy in the exercise of your political rights as Americans, the President of the United States, the Secretary of Defense of the United States, ordered that your group be spied on. And it doesn't have the slightest bit to do with Iraq, not the slightest bit to do with Afghanistan, not the slightest bit to do with Al-Qaeda or the SOB who threatened America yesterday. And the President of the United States and Americans need to understand what this president is all about in engaging in the NSA program that he is unfortunately engaged in. And the question in my mind becomes, if what the president is doing is entirely legal, then why wouldn't he have just gone through the accepted legal process to begin with? If he had gone through that process, we are told that on 13,000 occasions, he could have legally possibly done what he did in that Quaker church. But apparently, the President of the United States and the Secretary of Defense have chosen a different path with no court approval to spy on people like you and the 79-year-old grandmother and these other patriotic Americans, and there shouldn't be a single American that today remains confident that it couldn't happen to them, because it happened to them in Palm Beach County. Thank you very much, Mr. Hirsch.
Thank you, Congressman Wexler. I'd like to point out that I don't think that we are, as we've been painted in the press, completely harmless. I mean, the Department of Defense has labeled us a credible threat, and I think the truth is always a credible threat to illegitimate and unjust power.
And that was Richard Hirsch of the Truth Project in Florida, a recent victim of government surveillance, testifying at informal hearings held by John Conyers on illegal wiretaps of Americans. The hearing took place last Friday, January 20th, in Washington, D.C. The full-length version of the hearings are available from Pacifica Radio at pacifica.org. Some event announcements for listeners in the Finger Lakes, and a glimpse of what we're up to out here for those of you listening elsewhere in the country. On Thursday, January 29th, there will be several events in Ithaca as part of a car share summit. A facilitated planning session will take place from 11 to 4 at the Tompkins County Library Borg Warner Room on Green Street in Ithaca, followed by a lecture that evening from 7 to 9 on the Cornell campus by directors of car share programs in San Francisco and Boulder, Colorado. That is in 101 Phillips Hall. See IthacaCarShare.org for more information. That's Thursday, the Car Share Summit, IthacaCarShare.org. Then on Friday, the Finger Lakes Permaculture Institute will be holding a Skillshare on seed saving from 6 to 8:30 p.m. in the Workers' Rights Center upstairs from Autumn Leaves Used Books on the Commons in Ithaca. Bring seeds to trade, favorite catalogs and books, stories, and other insights to share with the group. That's Friday, January 27th, 6 to 8:30 p.m. This is the first of an ongoing series of Skillshares to be offered free to the public by the Finger Lakes Permaculture Institute on the fourth Friday of each month, which will encourage a topic for discussion, aiming to stimulate conversation and the exchange of resources toward all things sustainable. For more information, flpci.org, flpci.org.
I was driving down some big highway, somewhere going someplace, through a town that looked just like the last. I passed a billboard that said, if I buy that shit I'd feel better. I just pulled off to fill up the gas. and the truck stop TV showed the president's face with the stars and stripes waving in back. He said, "My fellow Americans, I can assure you today, peace and freedom is why we attacked. And it's days like these I find myself growing cold, trying to hold the rage that I feel. In this country of hearts that are freezing like ice, in this nation asleep at the wheel, I feel like I'm clear cut. I feel like my rivers have run dry, and I'm raw beneath the open sky and the rain. When it comes, will carry me away in a landslide." Everywhere I go, I see people who know something is terribly wrong. They say there's nothing anyone can do about it now. It's been going on for way too long. And all we can do is just learn how to cope, try to make it through another year. Yeah, who needs dictatorship or martial law when you got TV, dependence, and fear? Meanwhile, the kings and queens in their castles are trying to turn everything they touch into gold. And even the devastation they leave in their wake is a new market to be bought and then sold. I feel like I'm clear cut. I feel like my rivers have run dry, and I'm raw beneath the open sky and the rain. When it comes, carry me away in a landslide. If this broken world was all I knew, and all I heard was sorrow's cry, of anger and hope, or for what would be worthy to die? But I have seen forests as old as riverbeds. I've seen trees that rise up to the dawn. And I have known love that rises above the despair that this cruel world brings on. I've seen beauty in the eyes of another. I've heard music you would not believe. And the source of my pain is the source of my hope in a vision of what this world could be.
Ethan Miller and Kate Boverman, Clear Cut. Thanks for the music, Jim Page, and for our theme, Unwelcome Guest, performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Our website, where you can download MP3s and podcasts of the program, unwelcomeguests.org. Thanks for listening.